Lecture 4, as we continue our journey through the whole notion of community engagement, let's begin to explore that other kind of key aspect, which is what do we mean by that term which is used quite frequently in a number of key issues, whether it be community radio, whether it be community spirit, whatever sort of aspect we have to be, whether it be community subculture. All kind of key elements that relate to what do we mean. I mean, traditionally, you get the glorious Great British community there waving their Union Jack flags prior to, obviously, Scotland declaring independence, and we'd probably just be left with the cross of St. George and so on. Or maybe not, who knows. But nevertheless, there is that notion of tradition, of having something which really demonstrates quite clearly that there's a shared background, a shared range of experiences. What does it mean to be Swedish, Swiss, Portuguese, English, British? What are these kind of areas that are actually there? Is it more than just a label that we actually sort of have? Is it something that transcends boundaries of age, of gender, of race? You know, how do we work through that? I mean, the BBC works very much on the basis of reinterpreting and representing what we now kind of accept as the British way of life and so on. And representation is something that should never really be underestimated, particularly when you're looking for a diverse culture and a way with respect to that. Or is it that? You know, there's a celebration of community, and then basically you've got the mob. The mob who basically with flaming torches will battle up to defeat the creation of Baron Frankenstein, or burn books, or burn people, or burn a variety of other bits and pieces because they've been incensed. Because somehow our community is not their community. We are separate from the other. There's a complete difference in terms of how we view the others. It could be tribalism. It can be sport. It can be political. It can be ideological. It can be religious. It's kind of humanity's had this thing over the last few millennia, really, of separating us and them by kind of deciding what we are and what the others are not. Well, Benedict Anderson, what is he there, actually possibly coined a really accurate phrase of the whole thing, because it's whatever you want it to be. Your community, be that a community of undergraduates, of second years, of hockey players, of presenters. It's entirely up to your good self to really determine what those communities are. And bear that I word in mind, because as we progress through the next 40 or so minutes, there'll be a couple of clear examples of where, within a public relations point of view, you really start using the imagination to tap into various avatar-esque figures in terms of what communities happen to be and so on. So, there's another stage further. We move on from imagined communities to a community of interest, which is why I've highlighted that particular aspect there. And as Henri and Pudelko in 2003 effectively came up with, this whole notion that it's shared interests, shared values that really impact in terms of this. A gathering of people assembled around a topic of common interest. If you have no interest whatsoever in, I don't know, pet therapy, why would you actually join a community which actually deals with vets? Pointless, really. If you do, maybe you would. Maybe you'd actually have that shared interest in there. What are the kind of responsibilities of that community? Well, in the same way as we talk about the student community, the academic community, the shared community, etc., information exchange. This is fundamental to how social media works, of course, because you're unlikely to join sites or areas that you're not at least mildly interested in, which again can be good or ill. It can reinforce your prejudices, or it can actually open up to new experiences and so on. Equally, it's a case of how do you improve your understanding? How do you share common passions? It may simply be that most complex and yet essential of all human activities to play. The more complex the mind, the greater the need for the simplicity of play. Does anybody know which television series that's coming from? The more complex the mind, the greater the need for the simplicity of play. I'll tell you what, I'll leave it with you until tomorrow. Maybe you might have Googled it by then. Because I don't want to spoil it at this particular stage. I think it's like a little narrative hanging trope, a little exercise to do between today and tomorrow. Okay, what do communities share? Well, certainly they share values. You know, these are common sort of things that we would actually work through. We normally would share beliefs. You know, we just had the canonisation of John Henry Newman, the first English individual to be canonised, made a saint by Pope John Paul. Some people might say, fantastic, this is great news for Birmingham and more. It's great to actually see Pope Francis effectively connecting with Prince Charles, and all very good. Others might have no connection with that whatsoever. They might completely disengage from that whole system. But it still doesn't ignore the fact that, you know, one of the whole notion of actually being made a saint means that you share that belief that somehow, whether you've actually created or been responsible for a miracle, healing or whatever, you know, the kind of criteria that's used in terms of how you actually become a saint within the whole system, you still basically have certain beliefs which you think may be true, although, and this is the essence of belief, you might not be able to prove it. Can anybody prove the existence of God? Probably not. Can anybody prove on the reverse that there isn't a God? Probably not. So where do you actually work on that? And why is it that you get so many appalling atrocities carried out in the name of one God being better than another God? And so on and so forth. Attitudes. Kind of is almost a kind of criteria, that hierarchical structure. You got your values, what's important. You got what you believe happens to be important. And then it's a case of, well, classic line, deeds, not words. Applying to your experiences and doing the things that actually are influenced by both your values and your beliefs. Because if you don't believe in something at some fundamental level, what's the point? You know, if you don't believe that actually public relations is a really important subject, what's the point of being in, you might as well do, veterinary surgery or something? What are the attitudes that, I mean, the attitudes are basically you turn up, you show up, you work through that process as well, in terms of that whole sort of system of implement. E.g., examples, you could have your shared friends, your friendship group, whether you're interested in consumerism, shopping. Do you actually follow the line of Page and just interested in the drinking as opposed to something else? I don't know, so I can remember the line of that. Or do you take various other lines there? What are your beliefs with respect to that? You know, we can choose our friends, we can't choose our family, at least not that I'm aware of. I mean, maybe on a sort of metaphysical level, we actually all choose to actually be born into families, etc. But again, I can't prove that. But again, there is that notion of where you're looking for. You know, how often are you in a situation where you think, well, actually, you know, there's a sort of stage in life we all go through, I think at some particular period, where you think, parents are really difficult to bring into the world. How do you actually relate to that? And what's the attitude with respect to that? You know, who do you relate to? Who are you more likely to go to? I mean, is it likely to be... I mean, again, everybody has different times when they will react differently to exactly the same question. And these are just literally examples of how things can be developed. Have we ever had a stage in Britain whereby in some halcyon, glorious past, we didn't have to lock anything up, we could leave everything open because nobody would actually want to steal anything, etc., etc., etc.? Maybe not. I don't know. It's always an interesting line to pursue from that. So let's consider now, drilling down a bit more, in terms of types of community and types of group that you've actually got there. Well, again, hierarchies. We love hierarchies. Hierarchical structures. Sometimes it's the way the world operates, whether it's vice-chancellor, deputy vice-chancellor, head of school, principal lecturer, senior lecturer, whatever, program leader, blah, blah, blah. You've got command groups, supervisors and subordinates. You know, we like to arrange things so they're in that basis. We've also got within that certain people who will do things, certain people who are tasked with doing things and actually actively working in that. And part of doing things means you want to more or less, when you take minutes of meeting, if you have action points, etc., whether it's Signet or whatever, you would be giving certain key things to do, etc. And inevitably, just through human beings being human beings, you're more likely to gravitate to those particular groups on an informal basis. You know, it's rare that you're going to be assessed with something which you just think, I can't possibly sort of stand this, I can't take it any way, shape or form, in any way. But, again, you might have an interest in terms of that. Likewise, friendship groups and reference groups. Reference groups are particularly interesting there, because I put that down as basically groups which actually seek social validation and social comparison. Basically justifying why you're here, why it's important, why your reference group actually works through. Certainly in terms of a society which is constantly looking for feedback, feedback after everything, you know, feedback after sessions, feedback after this. I mean, I kind of use it. Those of you who have done the sort of radio from me, I always use the line, if I get a reasonably interesting telephonic chat, are you coming back again? That's feedback. That's an initial sort of line from that. How does it relate? Yeah, on the one hand, yes, it is important, but at the same time, how far down do you actually go? You know, do I actually start asking for feedback on the first 10 minutes of the lecture? Because I've been talking now for 10 minutes. How's it been going? Is it all right? Is it okay? Etc. I'm getting a kind of feedback from sort of lines from that, and there's an on-level communication and so on. You know, at least nobody's sitting there with their arms folded thinking, what the hell is going on here? Etc. So you get a certain feedback, but how do you actually develop that? How is it then validated to progress and move on to the next stage? And when you're actually doing pitches, and when you're actually doing presentations and so on, you kind of work on that basis of how things are going. And also you want to find out how things are operating, because we don't just have one group that we belong to. The attitude that you have to your fellow peer students and your friends is totally different from the ones that you actually have to your parents. It's totally different from the ones that you might have to friends outside the university. It's totally different from the ones you might have to people you've just met in a particular environment, be that sporting one or whatever, etc. But that doesn't mean that you can't be a part of different groups. We all have different sort of attitudes, different approaches to that, and have a different style accordingly. Because each of those dynamic groups has got a different dynamic. People actually know you for years will relate completely differently to you than if you've basically just been known to them for like 1 week or 2 weeks or whatever. So again, it's that whole sort of system in terms of how you develop that process. It's one of the areas where, you know, it's one of the artifices of social media that you're kind of asked to instantly like, instantly dislike, etc. You think, I don't even know you. You know, it's why people every so often have a cull. Anybody here have a cull of their Facebook friends every so often and say, I don't know who the heck this person is. I really need time to go. Or it's a case of, no, I need every single one. Or Instagram, etc. It's more than just the numbers. But strength in numbers. Campaigns and campaigners emerge from group dynamics. Example, Ofcom, the official body for communications, telecommunications in Britain. They are responsible for issuing licenses for the likes of Siren Radio, Viking Radio, any commercial radio, and indeed they look after the BBC as well. If you want to start up a new radio station, much as you might like to actually say, I'd like to start up a radio station, here's £60,000, can I have one, please? You're not going to get anywhere. You need to form a group. You need to have a group of people who basically want to develop that whole system. You need to effectively progress it for them. It's a bit on another level, like the student union official line, that PR society has to be affiliated. It has to be connected from that point. You can't just declare independence, etc. Well, actually, you can, but again, there's a whole range of things there in terms of if you do that as an individual, you're probably not going to be listened to. If you have a group of people who actually sort of acknowledge it, then yes, you will. This is the heart, really, of that whole kind of argument about we don't want to be part of Europe anymore, say some people, etc. So, you know, it's all about the campaign, the groups, etc. Which brings us, of course, to the E word. How do you ensure that you all speak from the same page, that you're all on the same page, that you all have a kind of uniformity, because that's where you get the phrase strength in numbers coming from. Because if there's more than one sort of person, a group of people, you get a kind of group mind, hive think, you can actually sort of start developing things that you want to specifically address and become representational of what things are put into place. So how do we then apply all that to our system? Well, here's an example, okay? There is the problem. You're in Texas. Yeehaw. You've got oil, you've got money, you've got basically the American version of Yorkshire. Because Yorkshire's regarded as like the Texas of isn't Helena.
Okay.
So, the state, the government of Texas, had spent $25 million a year on litter. Not creating it, actually trying to solve the problem of litter. And those costs were going up to 26 to 27. That's a substantial amount of money to be faced with. And obviously, first thing you actually do is, well, let's advertise. Let's say, you know, keep Texas tidy, take litter home. Let's look at that. But it's causing problems. It's causing a challenge. They tried that. It didn't actually work. Indeed, you even actually had a whole range of advertising and marketing companies putting together this whole thing, GSD&M, charged basically to create a slogan for anti-littering. And, say, just highways, big problem. Everybody agrees it's a big problem, but people are still, damned Americans, possibly tourists, maybe Mexicans, I don't know, throwing out litter from their cars, not caring about the environment and so on. This is in the 80s, kind of where there's an environmental consciousness, but you're not working through that whole process. And there we have the whole sort of system in terms of the whole system that Texans actually believe that littering is a God-given right. You can throw your trash anywhere. It's God's country. You should be able to just throw that. That's embedded in society in terms of where things are going. You know, beer cans, other items. I mean, I think we've all experienced the sort of notion of the irritation you feel if you're in front of, if you've ever been in a car and the car in front of you is chucking. You think, what the hell are you doing? I personally have a particular bent noir against vaping. First I saw a vapor in the car, I thought the car was on fire. I was very nearly going to rush out and say, yeah, put you, stop it now. God. But, you know, at least say that's atmospheric pollution, perhaps. So you've still got this issue where the problem is actually there, but your PR challenge, and indirectly your marketing challenge, is how do you start addressing that? What's the way forward? Well, administrators are regarded as buzz cutters. That's basically very severe haircuts. Conservative kind of characters. We use the term redneck American in terms of lines from that point of view. The advertisers also suggested that the average age of the board that they were sort of selling to was about 107. So they're kind of not really in touch with any kind of youthful dynamics, etc. And as the thing recorded, with the crowd was sprinkled with Keep America Beautiful, Keep Texas Beautiful folks, and a representation of 18 to 24-year-old young males. We then actually moved to this whole system whereby the person who's talking about Keep Texas Beautiful actually said, could you at least say please? To which McClure responded, no ma'am, you cannot use the line if you put please in front of it. So he wouldn't use the line please keep Texas beautiful, or indeed keep Texas beautiful, please. You know, this is basically discussing how can we at least get a slogan that's going to impact in terms of how people actually work with their litter, etc. And slogans are so vitally part of the whole system, whether it be take back control, whether it be no taxation without representation, any of those things, education, education, education. And you're actually getting problems with respect to what we're seeing, that rivers are becoming polluted, that littering is all there. You're not getting a very nice place for it with respect to Texas, because those anti-littering campaigns had one thing in common. They were not working. Bring in the local consultant. Look at the behaviour. Who were the chief litterers in terms of this? Shockingly, men between 18 and 35. And again, any rubbish, they were just leaving on the highway, scattering for that point of view onwards. Because why would they be caught? This is pre-CCTV, nothing else happening from that perspective. But let's go back to where we started. Let's look at this subgroup of litterers. Let's look at how they're actually engaging in behaviour that we don't engage with, or we don't think is appropriate, we think is actually antisocial, etc. How do we start digging into the notion of what do they think is important? What are their values? What are their beliefs? Do they genuinely believe that actually is their right to basically throw as much stuff on the highway as possible? What are the attitudes, again, that are then influenced by the first two things? You're kind of looking at, again, the theory that's actually used to say, when you're looking at your campaigns, what are the values, what are the beliefs, and how are they influencing and tying in to the attitudes and what people are actually seeing. So they responded by creating this character, Bubba. Fictional character, doesn't exist at all. Look on YouTube, you can actually see the thing from that point of view. And in terms of Bubba, this redneck Texan, possibly 18 to 35 male, they asked him these kind of questions. Or basically they asked the questions about the particular character. What did he, deliberate, because they found that was the major problem, what did he care about? What did he wear? Where did he shop? What did he do on weekends? What you're doing here is basically profiling. Okay, not that this is a criminal CSI investigation thing, but it's, you're basically getting an overall line of the profile of the character that's really responsible for causing these problems. Now, maybe you're looking at cliches, you're looking at stereotypes, etc., but at least you're getting an awareness. I mean, if you're shopping regularly in fast food stores, etc., then maybe that's some of the sort of litter coming out of that fast food store, etc. Maybe it's a case of if you go on weekends, you're shooting, you go to the ballpark game, etc., who knows where things are going. And so they built up this whole profile, as you can see there. They started working on how Bubba was presented, how he was working through that, and they started engaging with that whole particular profile. Why? Because they wanted to find out what was the most important thing that would basically convince him that people like him in the group, were not engaged with littering. So you're not naming and shaming. You're not basically saying it's you, you're not using a yes and thou, but you are using a technique to use a neutral notion of what do you really want, etc., what is most important. If you can get them to that notion of it's pride in the state of Texas, then maybe, just maybe, you can actually start using that whole line of changing the behaviour to start beginning to improve the overall thing. In this particular case, reducing littering. Okay, seeing how things work through that. It's what we see now as the beginnings of nudge theory. It's working on that whole system. When they actually work through that, they finally didn't have any pleas. They don't please, don't litter, etc. They simply said, we want to target people who are really fundamentally, yeah, all around American, yee-haw boys, etc. Don't mess with Texas. Don't mess with Texas. Can you see how it kind of emerged and actually came to that line, those four words, basically, to really focus down in a way which can at least start impacting on where we've come from in terms of the overall attitude that we're looking to change, how they're adjusting that, and so on. Any questions so far? Don't mess with Texas. There it is. That's what they actually produced. And it worked, you know, because again, you know, none of this anti-littering signs, etc. Very simple, very basic slogan, but formulated through actually addressing those key theories and working through that. So you had a step-by-step approach. Who are your audience? Who are the people? Who is the group? Which community are you looking to engage? How do you get them engaged in a way which basically hasn't got them switching off and saying, I'm not interested, Greta, just go away, you horrible Swedish girl, or whatever. How do they actually connect with that whole side of things? How do we, you know, relate to that? You've got the state of Texas, you know, big state for that. Don't mess with Texas, you know, all the lines from that point of view. I mean, obviously, this one has got the subtext up to $1,000 fine for littering, which might possibly sort of underpin the line of saying that. But at least you're saying impact in terms of people's attitudes and behaviour. And litter is one of those areas where, yeah, you know, how do we? I mean, here they've taken all the bins away from the offices and they put recycling bins in, and maybe that's going to work. I don't know. Maybe you will get to a stage where, you know, you don't get the littering put together from that point of view. And again, the attitude that you're actually getting by using images of masculine major boxers and events, etc., saying don't mess with Texas, is you're reinforcing that messaging. And that message reinforcement results in success. This campaign has worked. Bubba, fictional character, but representing masculinity between 18, 25 and so on, 35, you know, effectively there, and is still kind of used as a subtext within that, as a statement, don't mess with Texas. Success. Will it work all the time? Who knows? I mean, again, it's repetition of various other bits and pieces. Because ultimately, Bubba is what we would refer to in PR speak as a persona. You've developed that campaign, you're looking at this, and I use the term avatar, you're looking at somebody that people can identify with on the basis of saying, yeah, okay, I know this Bubba may be not existing, etc., but he does, he obviously, you know, represent, back to representation, certain key attitudes in our particular community that can work in terms of that change. And it's not as though, because you might well say, well, you know, surely these were adult males, they shouldn't need, you know, kind of childlike representation of don't mess with Texas, etc. Clearly they did. You know, you almost need to dial back the message to the extent that literally, to use the KIS motto, keep it simple, or KISS, keep it simple, stupid. You had to work on that. So, what are personas? Well, we would say they're made up. Hypotheses. You're basically making suppositions about what people actually are. I don't know if there ever was that particular ideal Bubba character. Sometimes you find somebody who was the archetypal literate. I'm using the term, actually, without mention, archetypes. These are similar to stereotypes, but they're shorthand ways of describing people. Young, gifted, and black. So you all sort of saw from that point of view. Likely to sort of be a late conservative voter, etc. You know, there are certain stereotypical images that come to mind. Whether it's good drivers tend to be a particular gender, bad drivers tend to be. You know, what are the archetypes that work through on that? But they also representations of real people. Hypothetical, archetypal representations of real users. That's what a persona is. That's what you're looking for in terms of your campaign to actually find out what personas actually do if you decide to go down this route. I mean, again, one of the things over the weeks you'll see, there's no one size fits all. These are various theories, many of which have been proven to work in certain circumstances. But you may not, if you try this to stop people littering in Lincoln, have the same success. You may do, you may not do. I don't know. It's just a way of actually sort of applying that whole system. But what personas do, as opposed to do-do, which is obviously poo-poo, which is the wrong thing entirely, get rid of that. But actually, how interesting, it sort of took a long campaign before people would actually take pooper scoopers around to follow their dogs and basically sort of pick up sort of various things from that point of view. Long time, you know. It's my dog, he should crap wherever he wants to. Right? Kira, I'm sure you always looked after your dog and made sure he doesn't sort of just leave little marks and messages all over Derbyshire, or maybe not. But either way, you're using personas to identify the motivations, so basically motivate, what actually makes them get up in the morning, what actually sort of focuses them, what are their interests, that's what we mean by motivations. What do they expect? What key things are they looking to in terms of how things are what are their objectives in essence? And then basically what are their short-term goals and long-term goals, possibly aims and objectives. All of that is developed by this scientific method. This way in which you gather data, you'll use questionnaires, you'll use focus groups, you'll look at basically surveys, you'll evaluate sort of things, you'll gather data through one-to-one interviews, you'll gather it from what you actually see. You know, how do people react when you're observing them, doing this kind of thing? What are you people watching? It's great sport from that point of view. We were actually commenting on Sunday, actually, Polly, about how you could actually see a whole range of things between the impact of the parents and, indeed, the prospective students. The prospective student and the parent. And you're kind of making already some assumptions and presumptions and suppositions about the kind of character or student they actually are. It's inevitable. Now, that might have a basis, in fact, and if you actually see it as a regular pattern emerging, you might think, so how do we change this, if we want to change it, to maybe adjust who we're actually targeting? Are we speaking to the parents? Say, yeah, just go away. Are you speaking to the child, etc.? What's the sort of way forward? But again, it's an interesting line from that. Okay, let's look a little bit more in terms of having moved on from Texas to some of the sort of generic things that relate to health issues, specifically breast cancer research today, and how that sort of operates from that point of view. So, you're looking at, again, your observation in terms of how individuals actually relate to your organisation or issue. What's the age, income? This could be anything from Macmillan nurses to a campaign for healthcare to all sorts of other areas. You know from your data gathering that 33% of women between 25 and 40 are interested in supporting breast cancer research. So there is an interest there, you know that. You also know that deciding to give to this charity as opposed to that charity is often implemented by graphic design, messages, what are the sort of key elements coming through that. You know, we've recently heard that one of the key things that's impacting an awful lot of charities is people no longer carry money. So the notion of actually giving money in the street, it's gone. Result. But if you're using your credit card and you basically let pennies matter, and every penny counts, and there is an organisation called Pennies which has a little bit for your bank account, just a couple of minutes, you know, if you can identify which charity it goes to, great, you know, you're not losing approximately £6.5 billion a year to charitable donations, which is the ballpark figure you told it. You're still making that charitable thing. Now, you may not be interested in giving to charity at all, but you may be, being nice, decent human beings, and there you have to say, well, I don't want to give to every charity, because there are certain charities which I prefer, and others I just won't, etc. So again, how does that target your good self? Let's create a persona, though. Let's look at this hypothetical, relatively young woman, 36 years of age. I know, ancient compared to yourself, but what the hey, 36. She wants to give to breast cancer today, but she's concerned that basically she doesn't know about how her money's going to be spent. Really important challenge. How often do we hear times of, yeah, X charity takes that amount off the top, pays for the executives to go off on benders overseas. You know, oh, that's what happened to Oxfam last year, or a couple of years ago. You know, there are lots of stories that are regularly broken about, where's the money going to go? Is it going to go into one particular person's pocket? Is it a case of that's a nice little learner? It's charity, give it to charity. Where are we going to go? Are you going to guarantee that your donation is going to go to the people that actually helps it? So obviously, what you need to do there is reassure. You need to provide information, and you need to quite clearly demonstrate how her 10p, 50p, £50, £100, whatever the donation happens to be, is going to be used. And you're demonstrating that. In other words, from an ethical point of view, you are quite clearly operating a transparent system. The University of Lincoln's a charity. We were asked as staff to actually donate a portion of our salary on a monthly basis. You must be effing joking. No, it's not going to happen, because obviously it's a nice try, I appreciate where they're going to, but hang on a minute here, slight sort of, you know, walk fast. However, maybe another sort of route could be that actually, yeah, I do give £9 every month straight off the top for the privilege of possibly getting a car parking space. There's no guarantee, but at least, you know, £9, well, you're in a lottery, basically. Don't do that, forget it. Interesting. Another survey coming out today in terms of, for staff, how we have to fill in our transport because we need to address how we're travelling to university and so on. Perhaps we should just stay here overnight, really, as we wheeled out when we come in. Never mind. That sounds bitter, doesn't it? I'm not really bitter, but let's step away from that. Let's move on. Okay. This is a line from a corporation, Google V1, who came up with this whole notion of personas. And it's worth just spending a few seconds just sort of working through that process and just reading that. Should I put it up in bold? Each strong brand has a tribe, so tribe, of people who share affinity with the brand's values. Personality and characteristics towards the brand can be understood quite simply in terms of common values, attitudes, and assumptions. It's kind of almost getting towards that holy grail of saying, if we know what people actually want, we might be able to provide them with what they need. Having said that, there is a difference often between wants and needs. It's a big sort of philosophical sort of attitude in terms of we know that people need food, but if they want Coca-Cola and junk food, is that going to help them? I know. What are the advantages of personas then, according to Jenkinson, back in the 20th century? Well, as we said, we don't really like robots, even though we live in an age where we've all got our additional add-ons and devices and ways of actually shutting ourselves down and say, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm doing my Facebook updates or whatever, Instagram, whatever. But if you have a human face that's otherwise unoccupied, you know, data, we don't like data, we switch off. I start talking numbers and, you know, very few people actually are really fascinated. I mean, some are, but in most cases, you don't really relate positively to abstract data. It's one of the reasons we always say when you're doing reports, when you're doing things for, you know, your RIP flag projects, etc., use pie charts, use graphs, etc. Don't just give me a whole load of data. Give me a visual representation of what we're actually seeing, what things are about, etc. Because that makes it a lot easier to communicate to, in this case, engineers, people who are actually sort of structured to the whole thing. And also, you have a shared understanding of what your targets are having to be. You've got that shared community of interest, which clearly, again, is a win-win situation, because if your message is clear and it's been clearly understood, then usually you find that the thing tends to fit together in a virtuous circle. And, looking at benefits, it's more personal. It's not a faceless individual that's put you on call waiting for the last 45 minutes and you just want to get through to a human being who will actually sort things through. And it's something that's real, that's tangible there. You also can clearly identify needs and challenges, needs and problems, clarification. You can also, applying the sort of SWOT analysis that we looked at some time ago, look at opportunities, who is the real audience, and begin to come to some sort of understanding of what the limitations are, of what the desires of your audience group are, and so on. Yes, there's a lot of stuff that's actually there, but those benefits can really pay dividends, because if you are fulfilling those needs with your clients, they're going to keep coming back to you again and again and again, because thankfully, thank the Lord, somebody understands them. Somebody's willing to spend some time talking with them about the housing problem they've got, the issue they've actually got, the challenge they're faced with, the business they're trying to launch. All of those things are kind of critical in terms of what you're going to be providing for them. And it's what will make your PR company effectively win the contracts that others don't, because you're able to go that additional mile, kilometre. Primarily because you're not guessing. You are, as far as possible, never going to be 100% successful, but you're taking out issues relating to guesswork. More likely to revert to creating content around what is, you think, the best way forward, which might be fine. But going in and say, nah, forget it, you'll be doing wrong, do it this way. Why? Because I say so. Do it this way. Why? Because I say so. Do it. And round and round and round. You don't actually put the audience and the needs of your clients at the centre of the whole piece. And that is pretty much the whole essence of community engagement. We started off with the whole shot of the community. Every one of those individuals, whether it was the flag wavers at the start or the torchbearers on the second slide, were all communities. They all had beliefs. You may want to work with one group as opposed to the other. You may have to work with both of them. You're still looking at changing them. You have the communities with respect to the Texas young male litterers that were actually around. You've got charity-based things. But you've got to work it through what are their needs. You've got to use certain techniques to begin to address the issue of what they're looking for. Then you can start beginning to fit with your own products and company in terms of what's working through that. Because in the back of the mind, in the back of your mind, you've got the persona. Example of how effective this actually is, and probably for all the wrong reasons. The one thing that Dominic Cumming was actually spot on with respect to the Leave campaign, was he identified a group of disaffected, disenfranchised voters who saw themselves as disaffected and disenfranchised. He targeted them, he got 3 million extra votes, bang. We're at a Brexit success. That's a one level how it works. Probably for not necessarily the most positive things, but clearly he was using this technique. He was using it to apply that whole sort of process. What are the challenges then? Because we're in academia, nothing's 100% perfect all the time, otherwise we'd be no need to be here, we'd all be divine angels floating in the cosmos. Maybe we already are. You know? It's all just an illusion. Personas are not often mega scientific, okay? You're just getting a kind of general broad brushstroke picture of the kind of people that you're looking for. So you can have one or two difficulties there, and they are also made up. They are fictional characters that you're using in order to anchor. You know, let's go back to the coming side of things. Is there an example of the disaffected, disenfranchised, disconnected voter that you can easily sort of say, yes, it's Mrs. X from number 26, whatever? I mean, again, you're looking for that, but you still, on one level, there is evidence to suggest, yes, it is. That's how you got the tipping balance sorted out. On another notion, you've also got, I mean, that line there, personas give a cloak of smug customer centricity. A cloak of smug customer centricity. It's all right, we're a student-centred university. Everything's put around our students. Maybe. Such a point, yes. But at the same time, you can then distance your team from engagement with the real users, because you've got this fictional character, this persona, this bubba, who's actually out there, who you think, maybe they're connected, etc. But don't necessarily think that's the sole way through that. Sometimes, as Portugal said, it's better to actually use real-world stories. You know, we talk about public relations as being narratives. Maybe that can drive you from that point of view. Because also, if you've got this fictional character called Bubba, or this fictional character called, I don't know, make up your own name, make up a sort of system, that can actually often seem unserious and whimsical, because you're not dealing with their problems. So it can actually have a counterproductive effect. Because you're basically sort of getting this ideologue that's put in place there. You think, yeah, but what? How is that really relating to what we're about, etc.? So we kind of would suggest that this is one way to actually go in terms of not personnel stories, but persona stories. Very important you don't confuse the two. These are not personal stories. Everybody's got a personal story. And sometime, I'm sure you can share that with us somewhere general, but persona stories. First of all, establish a goal and a context. Why is that persona using the product or engaging in this particular activity at this moment in time? What is going to make interacting with that persona particularly successful? Be that Mr. X, Miss Y, or whatever you sort of want to sort of apply in terms of that. And how is that interaction effectively going to work at a relatively high level? Again, you don't have to talk about the minutiae of how you have to, you know, explain everything. Just how are you going to work on this basis? How is the thing going to develop? And then, at the end of the result, basically, what happens? Is it a success? Is it like Texas, where people stop littering? No, they haven't stopped it. I mean, there's a reduction. It has reduced, and it did have an impact. But, you know, maybe that's one of the challenges, that you always look at ways to revalidate, revisit, change things around. You know, we do it on an annual basis. You know, lectures I give now are not the same as the lectures I gave a year or so ago. Otherwise, I just play the recording again or whatever. Especially in this module, because I didn't teach it last year. So anyway, there you go. But it all impacts in terms of that. For instance, let's consider Fred. There's his background, his personal background, his role, his company information, his shopping and news and industry news preferences, and his goals and challenges. If you want to sell Fred something, it can be anything, a new pair of shoes, whatever, how are you going to start addressing that? How are you going to create his persona, or indeed, how are you going to deal with this mythical chap where you said that, you know, white, balding male, somewhere in his middle ages, etc., personal background, etc. He's educated up to undergraduate level, so he's got a first degree, he's got one child in college, one in high school. You've created all this routine, but why? How is that going to sort of dead? What are you trying to do with Fred? You know, what's the sort of thing? Is it a case of you wanting to vote for a particular topic? Are you looking for various other sort of things, etc.? Are you looking to actually check out his charity preferences? Are you looking to change his sort of attitudes and behaviours? But again, you know, what are the key things he's looking for in terms of, you know, goals and challenges? Success to Fred is a raise or promotion. His important values, job security, family recognition, church. You know, obviously, he's keenly committed to the church. He might have really strong religious beliefs. Sensitive. You know, you need to work through ways to get. Biggest challenges, new systems, managing people, keeping all balls in the air. Biggest objections, appearance, liability, suitability. Not state of the art. Oh, I don't know, state of the art. And obviously, looking dumb. So if you're talking about all this new technology, you think, oh, I don't know what's going on here. Sometimes using technology is great, but if you go into a potential client and you talk about all the sexy things you can do with Instagram and how you can do Instagram accounts and various other pieces, and they haven't even got past, you know, the first step of understanding that Twitter is something that birds don't do, you've got a problem. That was sort of ornithological birds as opposed to the sexist term to us, which really good. Okay. What I'm going to ask you to do is twofold for tomorrow. What? He's already asked us one thing, and that was actually find the location of the quote, "The more complex the mind, the greater the need for the simplicity of play." The more complex the mind, the greater the need for the simplicity of play. Okay, from a very famous TV series here. Extra bonus points if you actually identify the episode. I'd also like you, just as we've seen with Fred there, to create your own persona. How would you like to be portrayed with your own interests, values, etc., using that template that we put up there with respect to Fred and what we worked through, so that effectively we can actually say, oh, if I want to actually sell Caitlin this stuff, I need to be aware that she's quite interested in that, it's not interested in that, etc., etc. Same with Olivia. So don't worry, the data will be destroyed. I won't keep it as sort of security, but I just want you to go through that exercise of creating your own particular personas and see what sort of things come up and how easy or challenging it happens to be. Has anybody got any questions about what I've been chatting about for the last 43 or 4 minutes?
Could you go back onto the template?
Of course. It's the same thing, I mean, and all the slides, they are on Blackboard.
Yeah, I know. It's just, I'll find it easier on my phone.
Case in point, there we are, you see, again, just using that sort of template, because Blackboard's not as usual, but yeah, so just that sort of line from that point of view. Okay, if you haven't signed in, please do so, and I will see you in... Yes, just go to
7th.
Can I say anything? Yeah, sure. This,
you have a CV, right?
Yes. So, but yeah, that's interesting, quite what we'll talk about.